Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What if a lab test that normally costs $18,000 could be done on a smartphone device that costs $34 instead? You'd take that bargain, right? Well, researchers at Columbia University in New York have developed what amounts to a low-cost, pocket-sized lab, a device, a dongle, that plugs directly into your smartphone and can be used to test for several sexually transmitted diseases simultaneously with an answer back in just 15 minutes. These smartphone dongles were first tested in Rwanda on 96 patients, all participating in programs to prevent mother-to-child disease transmission. The results of the group's work were published in the journal Science Translational Medicine this week. Is this device a game changer for healthcare in the developing world? Will we all be able to perform rapid diagnostic tests on our smartphones? Joining me now is Sam Sia, who heads up the team of researchers working on this smartphone dongle. He's Associate Professor of Biomedical Engineering at Columbia University in New York. And if you'd like to see a video of how the dongle works, yeah, it's pretty interesting. You can go to our website, sciencefriday.com/bloodtest. Welcome to the program, Sam.
Thanks, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, in New York, we're always looking for a deep discount, but this number from $18,000 to $34 is just crazy. How is that possible?
Well, we've been working on this for a number of years now, for probably 10 years. And really, when we first started it, this was before the smartphone even came out. And we were working, and we still are working, in a field called lab-on-a-chip, or microfluidics. And the idea is to miniaturize fluid handling the way that a lot of electronics have been miniaturized. And so when we started working on this, we went through several versions. But of course, we saw the penetration of smartphones into society, which has been absolutely incredible. And so we changed the way we manufactured this and designed this this test so that it's done on a little system, this little dongle that can plug into your smartphone, plugs into the audio jack. So it actually works on all different types of models, because you don't have to change your headphones for different smartphones. So the dongle itself is $34 in cost, and that's reusable. But every test that you run, you have to have a separate plastic chip, and that costs about $1.50.
Goodness!
Yeah, so it is. Prices are coming down there, and you can test for multiple diseases, as you said.
Such as?
Well, so what we did here was we had a special interest in global health, working with a large number of partners, including the Rwanda Ministry of Health. And here it was looking particularly at one patient group, pregnant women, because we were trying to diagnose them for HIV and syphilis and other diseases before they can pass these diseases back to the newborns. And for HIV, it's pretty obvious why you want to do this. For syphilis, the newborns can die if you don't treat the women.
So potentially, what other diseases could you use it for then, besides HIV?
So we run a class of blood tests called ELISA tests. And so when you get your blood drawn and it goes into a lab and you hear the results back in some period of time, there's a group of the blood tests that are probably done on your blood called ELISA tests. And so we can't do everything, but it's quite a number of different markers. And so these are primarily protein-based markers or small molecules, anything that you can generate a so-called affinity reagent for. And this includes infectious disease markers, as we've done. It can include chronic disease markers, such as some cancer markers and diabetic markers, as well as just health and wellness. So you might be able to, you can measure your hormonal levels or vitamin levels as well.
Wow. Well, with a prick of a finger, right? Give us a little thumbnail on how the device works. I watched the video. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. So there's two parts to this. There's a disposable chip, which is one-time use. And so you would prick your finger just like you would do in a glucose test for diabetes patients, for example. And just with one drop of blood, it goes into a holder and you fill that tube just by capillary action. And then that holder snaps into this plastic card, and you just slide into the dongle. I have it in the studio here, so actually, yeah. You know, you can slide it right into the dongle, and then an app comes up on the phone, which tells you to press a button on the dongle. You press it, and then the results are recorded, and they can either be displayed on the phone or just automatically synchronized to patient records in the cloud, depending on exactly how you want to do it.
Wow. Is it possible you could integrate it into all these health apps that are showing up in the cell phones, the smartphones now?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there are some considerations there before that can or should be done, such mm-hmm. as data privacy and so forth. But certainly from a technical level, that is the vision. I think it's almost inevitable, actually, that vision will happen, not only for global health, but for consumers here back at home, where we can monitor all sorts of stuff in our body.
Do you have a company interested in marketing this already?
Well, we've been working with a company called Opco Health as our partner, and they're one of the co-authors on this paper. And we've certainly been talking to a number of companies, diagnostic companies, as well as some pharmaceutical companies. But I think what's interesting as well now is with the increasing interest in using smartphones for health, there is an increasing number of consumer electronics companies from Silicon Valley who are getting into this and are interested in this.
But if you can do it for $34 for what it would cost $18,000 in a regular lab, aren't you going to get pushback from the health industry on this?
Yeah, I should clarify. So that those numbers are right, but that refers to the hardware. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times there's already a sunk cost. So a lot of labs already have this equipment. Now, what we're looking to do is to expand access to ways that you can monitor your own body. So you can actually do this in a pharmacy. You can even do it at home. And that ultimately could save the healthcare system a lot of money because you don't have to do these expensive tests in hospitals, which is very infrastructure heavy. It's mm-hmm. much better if you do it at home. And so absolutely, you know, this whole field of so-called point of care diagnostics, I think has seen some ambivalence from traditional diagnostic companies because is it a threat or should they be working with them? But I think what's really interesting now is that with the entry of smartphones and consumer electronics companies, that we really have just more companies and more capital available to develop these tests for people.
And so how soon can we get one? Does it have to pass tests like FDA approval, things like that, for the American public?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not going to be available overnight, even though I think that vision will absolutely happen at some point. But there's a few challenges that one has to overcome. One is there are some improvements that we'd like to make as well on a technical level. For example, we want to improve the shelf life of these chips to at least months in stability. But in terms of non-technical challenges, this whole field of consumer health is really exploding right now, and the regulations are changing as well. So there are well-established regulatory pathways in the FDA for these types of devices, called 510K and PMA and so forth. But with the convergence of consumer information, consumer access to this kind of information, a lot of these regulations are still being adapted. And then finally, the business model itself, who's going to pay for it? And the hope here is that we can bring the test down to such a low cost that people can just pay for it themselves. But still, to convince the insurers to pay for it would be still another process.
Well, if you get it down to, you know, $1.95 a test, or less than that. That's what it costs, less than...
For multiple tests, actually.
Yeah, and they're paying a lot more than that for the tests now. So they should be... And it's very accurate, right? It's just as accurate as the regular test.
Yeah, I mean, there is some variability depending on what we're looking at. But for most of the markers that we've looked at, the quality, I would say, is comparable. It depends a little bit on the specific marker, because if it's a very sensitive marker or you need to be very precise, then our dongle might have to be a little bit more than $34. But it's something that I think can technically be done for just about any marker.
Okay. And you said these were for small molecules. Could something be adapted for other kinds of tests?
Yeah, proteins, small molecules. These are so-called immunoassays, so something that you sort of capture something with. You have to generate right. something that captures onto it. There are other classes of tests that we're also working on, that other people are have been working on as well, such as looking at DNA and RNA and so forth. And I think most, if not all, these tests will be miniaturized at some point. Some of those tests, most of those tests are, I would say, a little bit harder. This is probably the one of the easiest tests you can do that still has very broad right. Applicability.
Was it nanotechnology that made this possible?
It's a number of things. Nanotechnology, we use gold nanoparticles in our mm-hmm. system. But there's a lot of, I would say, microtechnology, where the analogy is actually much more with microelectronics. Because there, we're not necessarily dealing with nano-sized transistors, but still, it packs quite a punch if you can shrink things down to a micro level.
So you're shrinking the circuit boards and things down that need to be done there.
Yeah, everything down the circuit boards, the fluidic circuit boards, if you will, as well.
So your drop of blood is the biggest thing, basically, on that chip.
Yeah, you know? Well, our chemical reagents are actually a little bit more than that, because one finger prick of blood is between 10 and 20 microliters. Some of the reagents that we have are probably on that order of magnitude as well. But everything fits within a little chip, so it's pretty small.
It's what it looks like, about an inch square, something like that. You stick it into the earphone jack, and it gets powered by the device.
Yeah, so what we've done is we try to replicate all the functions of these lab-based instruments into our little dongle, but in a way that they're also consuming very little power, to a point where there's actually no battery even in our dongle. We're drawing all the necessary power from the phone, so we're communicating with the phone through the audio jack, which has been shown by some other consumer devices as well, but we're also drawing power from it.
Dr. C.S. Sam, it sounds like great stuff. We'll be following you.
Well, thanks a lot, Ira.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Sam C. heads up the team of researchers working on this smartphone dongle. He's also associate professor of biomedical engineering at Columbia University. And if you want to see this in operation, how this works, very simple. It's a great little video we have on our website at sciencefriday.com/bloodtest. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last month, the Sci-Fry Book Club set off on a quest to find a lost city and a vanished explorer. We read David Grand's true tale of Amazonian exploration, The Lost City of Z, and it still is a great read. And now, after 3 weeks of wading through the Amazonian mud, we were bitten by mosquitoes, invaded by maggots, attacked by vampire bats, but we're still here and calling the Sci-Fry Book Club to order to share our adventure. And joining me now are three of our readers. Jeff Vandermeer is a novelist, editor, and author of the Southern Reach Trilogy. He joins us from Tallahassee, Florida. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're quite welcome. Sarah Partkak is an archaeologist, National Geographic Fellow, professor of anthropology, University of Alabama in Birmingham. She joins us from Birmingham. Welcome, Sarah.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And as always, our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff, joins us in the studio. She's here with us. Welcome back, Annie.
Thank you.
Let's talk, Annie, about the book. For book club newbies, remind us what The Lost City of Z was all about.
Sure thing. Well, on the last episode of the Sci-Fry Book Club, we met Percy Harrison Fawcett, who was a Victorian-era explorer, really kind of the last of this dying breed. And he sets off into the Amazon in 1925, along with his oldest son, Jack, and his son's best friend. And they're looking for what Fawcett has become convinced is a long-lost civilization, which he calls Z. And they disappear. And it becomes kind of this tantalizing mystery in the history of exploration, and one that our author, David Gran, sets out to solve by actually following Fawcett's footsteps into the Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I'll mention that we want to hear from everyone who's read the book, who's read Lost City of Z. You know, are you a Sci-Fry Book Club member? We want to hear from you. So give us a call. We're at 844-724-8255.
Mm-hmm. Hey, everybody. And let's get some from first impressions. Jeff, how did you like the book?
Oh, I absolutely adored it. I'm so glad I got a chance to read it. I think it's extraordinary in how the author manages to balance so many things, even heat and cold. For example, we're just about to our saturation point with the jungle when he brings up the polar explorer who joins Fawcett at one point and brings in all of that kind of evocation of a totally different landscape. So there's all of that. There's the lovely contrast of having an explorer school, for example, for all these kind of curmudgeonly iconoclasts, which I can't even imagine sitting in on that. And then you have it giving way to something that's kind of more haunting than absurd by the end. So I loved it.
And if you want to comment besides calling us at 844-724-8255, you can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Sarah, your take on the book.
I absolutely loved reading it. It was a wonderful reminder that that we explorers belong to a great history of exploration. You know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. And it was really amazing for me to see so many of the struggles that we face today reflected in Fawcett's adventures, while at the same time so much has changed. Thank goodness when we go into the field today, there's so much less we have to worry about. It very much kept me to the edge, at the edge of my seat, and I kept peering over my shoulder, wondering who was peering through me, looking at me through the bushes, and a couple times I actually had to brush my arms off because I swear I could feel little bugs biting me. So it was a wonderful read.
Annie, what was your impression?
Oh, my impression of the book. I mean, as kind of a history buff, what I really enjoyed about The Lost City of Z was how Grand situates you at really what's a turning point in exploration. So you're kind of watching the old guard march off, and that's folks like Fawcett, the gentleman explorer, the dilettante. And they're kind of passing away. And what you're seeing kind of come up are the explorers like Fawcett's rival, who I loved, Alexander Hamilton Rice, you know, the multimillionaire, the technologist, the specialist who would go into the field with his airplanes and his aerial photography. You know, you kind of see the rise of kind of the specialist. And it's worth thinking about kind of what happens in that change that we see.
What I loved two things about it. There was so much to love about this book. But what strikes you immediately as you start reading is that you think you're reading a novel. You know, it's not a novel. It's real history, but it is written so well, so fluidly. It is a page turner. And the second is what struck me is many years ago, I had talked to biologists about visiting the jungle. And they said to me, you know, you really don't want to visit the jungle because it's going to eat you up. I said, oh, yeah, sure. Well, this book shows you in graphic detail how you want to stay out of that jungle because it eats everybody. Half the people that went into that jungle never came out, right?
What I love is James Murray's insect journal. It's quoted at length in this book. This is an explorer who went along with Fawcett into the Amazon, a polar explorer. And he becomes so consumed by these insects, he's really becomes crazy. So he has these entries that'll say things like, you know, left eye sadly blurred by gnats, you know, blood-sucking gnats, worst they've ever been today. And this is the entire contents of his journal. He's just obsessed with this, these things that are biting him and eating him.
844. I'm sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
Sorry, that extends to even Holt, the bird guy, who I had to write this quote down, who finds himself reduced to being a vagabond ornithologist or perhaps tramp bird skinner. So the jungle reduces him down, too, from his professional standing to something a little less.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Lots of people want to talk. Our number is 844-724-8255. Let's go right to Charlotte, North Carolina. Kit, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I read the book a little while ago, and I really liked the suggestion of the mythology of the shaman, local shaman, who would whistle, and these bot flies in your skin would, you know, reach out, and then they would squeeze them, and they'd pop out.
So this was a method for removing maggots. If they've kind of embedded themselves in your skin, the indigenous tribes would whistle and they'd pop out. You could get rid of them that way.
And you could have worms also growing through your joints.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Those are the kinds of things you don't think about. You think about the snakes. You think about other kinds of things. You don't think about the maggots and the worms and the diseases, all the diseases that are in there. Annie, a picture of scientific exploration on the cusp of major change. Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is the change that I was talking about, kind of this transition from the dilettante explorer to kind of the technologist. But Sarah, I know you go by the profession of space archaeologist. You know, you're all about the technology. I mean, what did you think of kind of the way Fawcett went about his work as a scientist? Did he rate as a scientist?
You know, I mean, for his time, you know, it wasn't just a shift in the use of new technologies, but what you saw was the birth of the field of anthropology, and what the last caller said about indigenous people sort of making this whistling sound and the maggots would come out. You know, for his time, he really did the best that he could, and by learning from sort of the local people of Brazil, he was able to improve his ability to explore. So obviously there are huge problems. You know, he was a person of his time, but he kind of did the best that he could. But yeah, I mean, he really did stand on the cusp, and I think it was interesting reading that, because I think today we very much stand on the cusp of a great change within archaeology, especially, you know, we're using satellites, we're using landscape scanning technologies, and we're able to see so much more and so much further and so much deeper than we've ever been able to see before. So it was really interesting thinking about what Fawcett was going through and the transformation we're going through today in archaeology.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as someone who uses satellite imagery in your own work, how would you go about finding Z today?
So, well, I would first look at the known archaeological sites in the area. You know, in archaeology, we go from the known to the unknown. And with this black earth that formed the ground around these sites, I would wonder, you know, to what extent does that change the actual chemical composition of the soil and thus affect photosynthesis in plants? And are the plants growing on top of these sites able to be viewed differently with different chemical signatures and spectral signatures using the satellite data? So I'd get NASA satellite data, I'd process it, I'd look for hot spots in terms of differences in vegetation health. And once I had a series of these hot spots, I would then commission an airplane and get it to fly over them using a technology called LIDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging. And archaeologists have used this technology to map entire cities beneath rainforest canopies. So, and it produces these incredible elevation models by stripping away the vegetation that's above what lies underground or just above the ground. So even from my computer thousands of miles away, I would be able to see exactly what's there before we mount an exploration.
Let's go to the phones to Monique in Anchorage. Hi, Monique.
Hi, thanks for having me. We read the book up here in Anchorage for our book club, which was a lot of fun. But I think what was more important to me was I'm Bolivian-American. So my parents are from Bolivia. I was born in the States and born in Chicago. And it was a really neat way to learn more about Bolivia and kind of the indigenous people there and what it was like. So much so that when I was done with the book, I sent it to a cousin of mine who now lives in the United Emirates, who then sent it to a cousin of ours who lives in Germany, who then sent it to an aunt of ours in Bolivia. And so it's kind of making the circuit around the family to learn more about our country.
So what did you find most interesting about the book?
You know, I did aid work in Bolivia in the Amazon Riverlets. We went to where the roads ended and then got on a motorized canoe and went 3 hours in to where there was really no infrastructure, but there were communities. It was a tribe called the Yurukaris that have independence from Bolivia within its borders. And so they have their own land that they walk each year and to remark their territory. And those walks were very similar to what was described in the book, as far as some of the challenges with bugs and temperature and humidity. Not as much as what's there, but I think that's something that has changed over time as we've had population decline and even species decline in the Amazon.
I have to get some more phone calls in, so I have to let you go there. Jeff, what did you make of Fawcett? Do you understand why he did what he did?
Well, see, that's the thing. I find him fascinating. You know, even just from a fiction writer's point of view, he's rich territory. He, I don't know that I feel sympathy or lack of sympathy towards Fawcett, even as he kind of destroys some of the lives around him by his single-minded focus. In a way, he becomes this kind of human version of the stone formations that explorers keep mistaking. for the work of human beings, and he just kind of is. He doesn't really have any free will by the end. He's so taken by this vision to the point where, you know, he has this talisman, this artifact that he carries around with him as proof of the city of Z. And to some extent, you feel like, you know, he really loves he must to some extent enjoy the day-to-day of being in the jungle, or he wouldn't keep going back, even though he has also this grander purpose. And, you know, that purpose itself, did he need the city of Z? Because unlike the polar explorers, he didn't have otherwise an end goal. Otherwise, he'd just be kind of like a glorified surveyor. So I find those things interesting. I find the way that it starts out, I mean, David Grand does a great job at the beginning of this book of showing how adventure stories speculate, actual fiction speculates as to like the hidden mysteries behind things in the Amazon or other mysterious places in the world. But then by the end, the fiction's contaminated the real world so much that in the wake of his disappearance, all these stories like portals to other worlds through the city of Z kind of spring up. And so I find that process fascinating. It's not just Fawcett's personal mythology that builds up, but then all this stuff around him.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about our book club pick. It's a great book, The Lost City of Z, in case you're just joining us. Maybe you've read it. Here with Annie Minoff. Annie?
Well, I think it's worth kind of thinking about how Fawcett changes over the course of, you know, between his first expedition and the last expedition. And Ira, I know you and I got to sit down with some book club members here in New York last night at the Explorers Club to talk to David Gran and to talk to them about their thoughts about the book. And Dan from Brooklyn kind of, I think, made this great point about how Fawcett changes. Let's hear what he had to say.
He was a military guy, and he had this sense of honor. And towards the end, he started calling himself a colonel as opposed to a lieutenant colonel. It's incredibly dishonorable to call himself a rank higher than he actually was.
Yes.
And it was almost like he became so obsessed that his sense of honor, his sense of ethics disappeared in the quest for achieving the sea.
So, I mean, you really kind of see him disintegrate and really become consumed in a way that is no longer about discovery, but is kind of destructive.
That's what Jeff was talking about.
Exactly
how it was changing. Sarah Fawcett, we know Fawcett dies, or will, because we've never found him. In fact, the author goes, part of the book is the author is going back to try to find and retrace his steps. But, of course, that's not the end of the story because... Grand finds Z or something like it, Sarah, right? He finds something that might look a lot like it, so you think maybe that perhaps it did exist. Were you surprised by that ending?
Well, I mean, in archaeology, you know, there's what people said 500 years ago, and then there's the reality of what exists on the ground today. And this is where I think using different kinds of technologies is helpful because we're constantly, you know, when we're looking at landscapes today, archaeologists don't see things as they are. Archaeologists try to see things as they were by removing what might be above the ground and trying to visualize, based on all the available data we have, what things might have looked like. So, you know, there may have not been a specific city per se. Instead, you're dealing with an incredible civilization. And as an archaeologist, that's so much more exciting because it means you can ask all these amazing questions about how people survived and how they were able to thrive and build these big, for then, large cities between 2,000 and 5,000 people that were all connected to one another.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, you said you were struck most by the ecology of the book. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I may have an outsized interest in this. My father is an entomologist who studies fire ants, and he's been down in South America for that, too. But I find, quite frankly, the efficiency of the jungle that keeps intruding on the expedition to be quite interesting. I also find that Fawcett has kind of an interesting view of the environment because of his experience. He's much more judgmental of men than maggots, as may have been remarked already. And, you know, I find it interesting that, you know, he's exploring for this human habitation while being surrounded by this amazing and almost alien ecology. And so, you know, the whole time that he's doing his thing, you know, all this stuff is going on around him.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I just find it interesting.
Yeah, I learned a lot about how efficient the the jungle is. It just, something dies, it gets eaten up immediately. People were starving on, you know, you think that the jungle is full of bananas and food and all kinds of stuff, but people are really starving there. So
But then there's also the soft versus hard tech kind of thing. The fact that, you know, he kind of notices to an extent that the Indians have what I would call very sophisticated soft tech.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is a way of like blending with your environment.
Now we're gonna come back and wrap up our discussion of Lost City of Z. And we're going to take a break, and when we do, we're going to hear, when we come back, from one of the book's characters. Someone in the book is going to join us. If you read the book, hopefully you'll be pleasantly surprised. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hey, podcast listeners, take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fry listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about our Sci-Fry book club pick, David Grand's story of Amazonian exploration. The book is called The Lost City of Z. Joining me are our book club readers, novelist Jeff Vandermeer, archaeologist Sarah Parkak, and Sci-Fry producer Annie Minoff. And last night, some Sci-Fry book club members, we all sat down with David Grand at the Explorers Club here in New York. And Jennifer from Queens at the club had a great question for David. She asked him, if Fawcett plopped down right in front of you now, what would you ask him?
The first question I would ask is, what happened in the moments of his death? How did it transpire? I would tell him to give him some consolation about all the incredible discoveries in the very place where he disappeared. I would share that with him. I would ask him why he brought his son, and did he ever regret that decision? Was there ever a moment, even if it was the moment just before death?
Hmm. Sarah, Jeff, I put that question to you. What would you ask Fawcett if he just popped up right now?
I think as a fellow explorer, I would ask him, what is the one thing that constantly drives him ahead? You know, when he's facing so many struggles, covered by bugs, not able to eat, on the verge of death, what is that one thing that pushes him to find this city? So many archaeologists today, you know, we're consumed by passion for what we do, and we all have different reasons for doing it. But that's the one question I'd ask him. What's that one thing that pushes him?
Jeff, what would you ask him?
I don't know. Maybe it's a strange question, but I would kind of ask him, like, what was the one day of your life while you're out on expedition that was, like, the happiest? Like, what gave you the most pleasure or the most calm or satisfaction? Because I really am kind of invested in this idea of whether he was more invested in the journey or if he was more invested in the conclusion, you know, in finding the city of Z. So,
yeah. Let me see if I can get one question in, one comment from any of our listeners here. Let's go to Beverly in Bloomington, Minnesota. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. I think it would be very interesting to compare this book with the book River of Doubt by Candace Millard, which describes the trip that Theodore Roosevelt took to try to discover the course of an unknown river through the Amazon jungle. Roosevelt took with him Candido Rondon, a Brazilian who had spent years in the jungle and more or less understood the tribes that lived there. And a lot of people think that the reason Roosevelt survived, though not everyone in his party did, in spite of incredible hardships, was that because they had Rondon with them, they were able to behave in such a way that the people in the jungle, who of course were watching them all the time, didn't kill them.
Hmm. Annie, comment?
I spoke to an anthropologist at the University of Pennsylvania named Clark Erickson, actually, about his thoughts on Fawcett. And the first thing he said was, why did he not take a native person with him? Certainly, he noticed on his trip, you know, none of these indigenous tribes are starving. You know, what do they know that you don't know?
Interesting call, Beverly. Thanks for that that note. I wonder what David would say if we asked David Grand.
Well, he didn't go by himself,
no,
for sure.
No, but maybe he has an opinion, you know, about that Canada. Jeff, you have any thoughts on that?
I do think that on the last expedition, it's quite clear. And you know, the thing about David's book is that he doesn't editorialize much, but it seems to me clear that he thinks that Jack and Raleigh may not be the best companions for Fawcett on that last journey. And so there's that to begin with. I mean, at one point, Jack is actually shooting crocodiles or alligators out of the window of the train. I don't know why. Yeah, you know, it's funny because he has this conflicted view of the natives the whole way through.
Yeah, well, you know, as we wrap up, I want to say thank you to both of you for taking time to be with us today. And our next guest, let me say goodbye to Jeff Vandermeer, author of Southern Reach Trilogy, co-director of the Shared Worlds Writing Workshop, Sarah Parkak, National Geographic Fellow, archaeologist, and professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Annie, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. It was great. Thank you all. Somebody who might know, we might ask that question too, who is a character in the last pages of The Lost City of Z. David Grand travels to a remote village in the Amazon called Xingu region, and there he spots a curious figure. Here's how David describes it.
His skin was white, although parts of it had been scalded red from the sun, and he had scruffy blonde hair. He wore baggy shorts and no shirt and carried a machete. It was Michael Heckenberger.
University of Florida anthropologist Michael Heckenberger has been working in Xingu for 2 decades. And when he shows David what he shows them in those final thrilling pages of The Lost City of Z, it really takes your breath away and adds a whole different dimension. He shows him a 900-year-old moat, enriched black soil. Remember, we keep hearing that the Amazon eats up everything that gets dropped there. So where does the soil come from? He sees the remains of a palisade wall. And everywhere they look, there are signs of ancient roads and causeways and canals. It's enough to make you think, well, maybe there was a Z after all. So Michael Heckenberger is here now. He joins us from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you, Ira?
Wow, that is a very interesting ending to that book, thinking that he gets shown all these kinds of things. You say Fawcett was in the right place, but he was looking for the wrong thing. What do you mean by that?
Well, I appreciate David's ending because he very clearly points out the amazing achievements of the indigenous people. And one thing that really didn't cross Fawcett's mind was the possibility that the indigenous people themselves had created complex architectural features and sophisticated systems of land management. And so he was looking for Atlantis and the Amazon. And so his trip through the Xingu was relatively quick. He had passed through the territory of the indigenous people I work with, the Kwikuru, quite quickly. He wasn't sticking around to look carefully at the very subtle things that are buried in the soil, the large distributions of ceramics, and as you point out, the moats and other earthworks that
so he was sort
clearly
of,
indicate something very different in
so
the past.
So he was sort of walking on what he should have been looking at.
That's right. That's right. And you can't really blame him. Nobody was really looking for that stuff. In most people's minds, the folks that lived in the Amazon were a relatively primitive level of human organization. And one thing I have to give Fawcett credit for, although much of what he did and said was obsessive at the least, even fanatical, he was one of the few people who recognized that indigenous people, some of them, were quite more sophisticated and complicated than people thought. Now, he thought that was because they had been influenced by the Atlanteans, or perhaps even a descendant population. It didn't really cross his mind that the indigenous people had done that themselves.
And so where did they all go? If they were there and they had created all these moats and great pieces of landscape, whatever happened to them?
Well, they're still there. The Kwikuru are descendants of those larger groups, which existed until after the discovery of the Americas, the conquest of the Americas. And when I went and first started working there in 1991 and 92, there was a fairly popular and new belief that Europeans coming into the Americas had really ravaged indigenous populations. And the Amazon was kind of a holdout. People thought that perhaps because of its inaccessibility and the tropical forest had insulated people. from the really rapid and massive die-off of populations from disease and colonial violence elsewhere. And that's what happened to them. The tropical forest didn't insulate them, and they suffered massive losses during the first century or so of European contacts in the Americas. Mm-hmm.
So what would the lost cities you've studied have looked like in their heyday? Can you paint us a picture of what it would have looked like back then and how long ago?
Well, they're very subtle and hard to see. When I first went to the Kikuyu village, I arrived at about 1:30 a.m., and the moon had just peaked out after a rain. We were about 12 hours on the river getting there. And all of a sudden, I kind of came across about a 300-400-yard bit of swamp that we had to wade through up to our chest, and then started to rise up a bank. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, appears this really quite large central plaza and the beautiful beehive-shaped houses that are around it. And so they're not easy to see when you're walking through a tropical forest that's quite tall anyway. You don't have large standing structures. You don't have big physical features. And so it's almost when you're right upon them that you see them. But what's really remarkable is in 1992, there was one Kikuyu village of about 330 people. The chief of the village brought me to an archaeological site about 2 weeks after I arrived and showed me one of these ditches, former moats or palisade walls, and I was absolutely stunned. The scale of it was remarkable. They're 5 meters deep and 15 meters across, and they extend for a couple of kilometers. We set about mapping them. It took a couple of months. But the really remarkable thing was when we discovered the roads and their orientations and followed them out and realized that just a few kilometers, a couple miles away, there is another one connected with this really amazing system of roads and bridges and other features. And so we have this image that an urban society or a civilized society should live in big single cities. And they didn't. They lived in towns and villages, but their system of communication and their network road systems really in many respects was more complex, more complicated than what we might find in the Grecian polis or in medieval towns in Europe. And so the remarkable discovery is that these ancient Xinguanus, the ancestors of the Kikuyu, there was as many people organized in their society, and they were distributed over an area as large as many of the civilizations of the day, but they were very diffusely settled. And they, to some degree, were almost woven into the landscape itself. So what you have is you have a central ceremonial site, and there's four primary satellites, and each of them are quite large. They're, about 150 acres in size, and just a few kilometers away from that center, one to the north, one to the south, one to the east, and one to the west. And that group of five settlements, you find that same kind of cluster organization time and time again throughout the region.
Michael,
so it was almost like a lattice work.
Wow. I have to remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Michael Heckenberger. I just have a couple of minutes left, Michael. So what about the future? Do you have work that you're still working on that we'll hear about that you're ready to publish? This looks like prime ground to till, so to speak.
Yes, we do have. We're continuing to work there. At the moment, we're going down this summer, actually, to build a cultural center for the Kikuyu and then back into the research. And we have some remarkable new discoveries. But one of the most important findings in all of this is the continuity of the indigenous people today, but also the fact that these cultures learn to work with the forest. And they kind of reworked the natural contours of the landscape in a way that's very different than many pre-modern civilizations and certainly contemporary things, which are clear-cutting societies, and they really have a very dramatic impact on the environment. the ancient Kikuyu, the ancient Xinguanus, worked with the landscape. And so there was a mosaic of features, features that diverted water courses into very productive harvesting systems, artificial ponds, a mosaic of forest and garden areas and orchards. And at the moment, as everybody knows, the southern Amazon, where the Kikuyu live, is the hardest hit area of the Amazon in terms of deforestation. It's called the Arc of Deforestation. And there's a very real possibility that the ancestors of the Kikuyu have some very important messages for how we might do sustainable development in the Amazon today. Huh. Many of your listeners may know that they're building quite massive dams and that the agricultural frontier is rapidly deforesting things. Well, what happens if, it rather than 6 mega dams, you build 6,000 smaller dams?
Okay,
because that's probably how many they had.
All right, Michael,
in 1500.
We'll wait to hear your results. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us. It's fascinating. Michael Heckenberger is author of the book The Ecology of Power, associate professor of anthropology at the University of Florida in Gainesville. One of the most noteworthy feats of exploration is not on this planet. It's on Mars. The team of Mars rovers that just keep going. But one of those rovers might come to a halt. This week, NASA published its proposed budget request for the coming years. And the request for planetary science was $1.36 billion, with one notable exception. The line for operating the Mars rover Opportunity in 2016 said zero, meaning the mission would cease operations. David Redzanowski, the chief financial officer of NASA, explained.
You have to make trades between funding new activities and new development missions that bring new cutting-edge science versus taking advantage of something that's operating well and also providing good science. You have to make those trades.
Radzanowski said that while the initial request in the budget was for no funding, the space agency would reassess the science down the road and possibly try to put back funding if the rover continued to be operational. Steve Squires, the principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover mission, says that the rover has lots of work ahead and that a recent peer review process had ranked the rover's science near the top of the various Mars programs.
The rover has continued to do good exploration and good science, and looking ahead of us at a place called Marathon Valley, we have what we think is going to be some of the best science in the mission. So I'm feeling very, very good about the future of this rover right now.
The threat to the rover is nothing new. The proposed cuts had been in this year's budget, too. And then the funding was restored after outcry from the public and from Congress.
As long as the vehicle continues to be mobile, as long as it continues to deliver good science, which we can right now, then it makes sense to keep going. And that's what I hope and expect will happen.
Mm-hmm. Even if funding for the rover stops, Squires points out that a functional rover will continue to phone home, even if no one is here to answer the call.
There's no way to actually turn the rover off. It doesn't have an off switch. And if we stop commanding it and stop listening to it, it will just wake up every day waiting for commands from Earth.
Steve Squires, the principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover mission. That's all the time we have for now. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Kristen Vitaliata, Alexa Lim, our associate producer, SciArts producer, Annie Minoff, Lou Groskin, our video producer, production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director, spinning the dials here in place of Sarah Fishman. At the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York, I'm Ira Flatow in New York.